Bienvenidos al Cuarto de Guerra, tu podcast en español de War Machine y Hordas, en la red de Museum Minis.
Welcome one and all to Cuarto de Guerra. My name is Álvaro and I'm speaking English today.
My name is Bernardo and I really hate Lord of the Feast. In English now.
My name is Santiago, and I'm slowly becoming a Winter Guard conscript because of my beard.
There you go.
My name is Ben, and I hope I don't cough a lot on this episode. And I'm also trying a lot of crazy lists as always.
That's now in English as well. Anyway, today we have, as you can probably tell, a very special episode. We have had this in the works for quite some time now, and we are really, really excited to finally get our official podcaster chops, getting some private press stuff joining us on the podcast. So let's just not waste any more time, because I don't like to speak English that long. And welcome, Matt. Matt, how are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Okay, Matt, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, especially for the listeners that maybe live under a rock and do not know who you are?
Excuse me, Alba. You're selling him short. You have to say that we are having Matt gets as a guest in our podcast, lead writer for Privateer Press and the.
But I wanted him to do that.
No, that's bad hosting.
That's well, who we are. Anyway, let's go.
I can at least confirm that yes, I am Matt Goetz. I'm the role playing game producer at Privateer Press, and responsible for shepherding the Iron Kingdoms Requiem line.
See, he did better than us. That's I'm just saying. But anyway, so of course we are super excited to have you here to talk about the Orgoth. That's the topic that we are tackling today, of course. All lore and RPG stuff related topics about that beautiful faction that is coming out real soon. But first, maybe you can put us in the realm of where are the Orgoth right now in the Iron Kingdoms.
Who are the Orgoth?
Yeah, we can start with that. That would be interesting.
For those of our listeners that live under a rock and do not know who the Orgoth are, maybe we could have a little introduction about who they are, what's their place in the Iron Kingdoms setting, and what are they up to now?
Oh, absolutely.
I like it.
So the Orgoth are really the reason there are Iron Kingdoms at all. They were conquerors from the west who came across the sea and landed on the shores of Imran and proceeded to take almost the entirety of the western half of the continent under their control. They were brutal, savage conquerors that used dark, infernal magics and harvested not just the goods of the iron or of Western Imran, but even the labor of its people and their souls upon death. They are the big bad that all the people of Western Imran came together to unitedly drive out of their lands.
That sounds harsh.
Yeah.
They're pretty metal.
Yeah, they are. They're pretty metal. Their old armor had a lot of horns, very like death metal vibe to their armor and their whole aesthetic.
Yeah, lots of faces. Horns and faces on that armor, right?
Yeah. Faces
like in agony. And
faces in agony definitely describe their aesthetic.
Okay, so of course we have like a bunch of questions for you, Matt, for this. So if you don't mind, we are just going to sort of just jump right into it. Santiago has a list. He's going to read them to us, and you can just fill us in on what you think of what we're asking. Okay, let's go.
Okay, first of all, there's so much to know about the Orgoth, because as you were saying, the big baddies of the Iron Kingdoms, but up until now we didn't know very much about them. Requiem, for example, mentions that the first Orgoth invasions had undead monstrosities marching to the battle alongside fierce armored warriors, quote unquote. Can we expect the Orgoth to sort of step on Krix's toes in this second invasion? That is, will they be bringing their own take on undead forces?
Well, it's interesting that you ask that, because so much of Krix's magic and technology, or their magical ability, definitely, it was taken from the Orgoth. So it's sort of, it's the Krixians stepping on the Orgoth's toes, not the other way around. But the undead monstrosities that the text references, the dread, were created from the bodies of slain Imerese people. They were like zombie shock troops with blades for hands, essentially. But if you're asking whether or not we're going to see those right away, probably not. Like, we know that the Orgoth's whole culture has gone through an upheaval, and that they've advanced, you know, culturally and technologically in the hundreds of years since we've seen them last.
Also, they need bodies for that. So first they have to do the killing.
Yeah.
To get the bodies. That makes sense also.
And funny that you say that what has happened in the last centuries in the Orgoth society. Can you tell us a bit more, within reason, about what sort of advancements had the Orgoth society gone through since they were expelled from Western Imorin?
Sure. Well, I mean, one of the most obvious is their adaptation of Mechanica. You can see it in the form of some of their improved new weapons on their warcasters and the existence of their warjacks. Because they're Orgoth, they definitely have taken a different tack on it, but those were inspired by their contact with the people of Imerin. Those were Imerese inventions that completely trounced this conquering army. So they, you know, had to look at it and say, all right, this is something good that we should adapt and adopt.
Mm-hmm. And exactly. Mechanica was, and the gift of magic, of course, by Tamar, was were the big deciding factors in driving away the Orgoth during their first invasions. And regarding Mechanica, the big breakthrough, according to current lore, was the creation of the first Colossus, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think we can say, according to you, Matt, I'm just saying, like, it's...
Well, that was all written well before my time at Privateer, so I can't take credit for that.
Yes, you can. We won't tell anyone. It's fine.
This is a podcast.
That is true.
Spanish.
Okay.
Things don't hear that then count.
The next question was, can you tell us whether the Orgoth will eventually in the near future bring some sort of answer to Western Immorans, Colossals, and Gargantuans?
Well, that's kind of difficult to say right now, because what we're seeing isn't everything that the Orgoth have to offer. This is just like the first foray, the first beachhead landing of soldiers back in Western Immorin. And, right. Like, who's to say what they're still keeping back in the armories, back in the home country, right? So it's not impossible that they might have something of the scale of a Colossal. We've definitely left room for that to happen, but I don't know if it's anything we're going to see right away in these first waves of attack.
Well, Colossi, they do fit in the boat. They might be difficult. If you have a raiding party, you wouldn't be bringing the big guns, just the things that are fast and hit hard, but fast.
Makes sense. We need bigger boats. That's what we need. There we go.
I mean, their boats are pretty big.
They should get one of those Cadorian flying vessels to bring Colossi, and then
oh, sure.
Drop them on Imaran. They will love that.
Well, I mean, who's to say if that's not going to be a turning point in the battle against the Iron Kingdoms, right? Yeah. The Orgoth seeing these flying vessels for the first time, because they're brand new again. I imagine some of the old Orgoth souls are like, wait, I have this growing dread that we're about to be bested by technology once more.
And then the Cadorans came in a giant flying ship. That will be very metal. Very metal.
Yeah.
Well, the Cadorans got hit pretty hard on this first attack by the Orgoth. So I'm thinking they will be a bit out of the scene.
While. I mean, after the events that when they sink the Cadorian warship and now on the Orgoth invasion, it's been a few years. They might have something new. We don't know.
Matt, feel free to pitch in this.
I mean, ravings and rumblings.
Cador got hit quite hard during the claiming, and now they're sort of the first victims by the landing of the Orgoth. So, in their best shape right now, right?
Even before that, right? Like the beginning of Mark III, we have Cador feeling like they're in control of the majority of Lael, and then a whole war gets kicked off, launched by Signar, who are not typically the aggressor. So they have that, then the claiming, and now the Orgoth. So it's definitely taken its toll of Cador and its people.
It's been a couple of rough years. Yeah,
yeah.
You could say that.
And then on that account, going through the Requiem, we can learn that during the first Orgoth invasions, there were three nations that were notable for resisting being conquered. Mm-hmm. There was Rul, there was Ios, and there was the Nightmare Empire, Kryx.
Yeah.
So, can we expect the Orgoth to account for these past failures, sort of have specific efforts directed to these nations or strategies or troops?
So when it comes to Kryx, the X factor there is always going to be the Dragon Father. Like, even when he's not at his most powerful, Torek personally went out to scorch an Orgoth fleet. And I'm sure there's some ancestral memory about that they're very, very cautious about getting too close to him and his power. When it comes to Ios, there's not going to be a lot left in Ios for them to worry about, right?
But the Orgoth don't know that yet.
They don't know that yet, but I imagine there's a lot of Eldritch that see them as just a buffet of souls to consume the life essence of.
Yeah. The guy in charge of planning the counter for Ios is going to be so bummed out. Like, I prepared all of this for you, and you are not there.
Yeah,
centers for this, and now nothing.
But when it comes to Rul, I can imagine the Orgoth might have some ambitions toward Rul. Fortunately, Rul has very strong, like, geographic protections on its border with the mountains and very narrow passes and lots of artillery. But Rul also is starting to see the benefit of bringing in refugees during the claiming years. So they're getting a lot more diverse approaches, diverse intellects. So Rul is probably going to be able to counter whatever new things the Orgoth might try and bring to deal with their failure in the past.
Bernie, you're our resident Rulic fan. You want to ask something about that?
No, I love what Matt is saying. I mean, the Rul are really strong, a very organized society, and like he said, they have a very geographical advantage. So if they do that, they can add some refugees and immigrants from different countries that fled the Infernals. They're going to be quite a tough nut to crack for the Orgoth. I guess even in the lore, in the setting, Rul should be considered now a major power. Well, they sort of were before, but now when they get those reinforcements, they should be really be a force to be reckoned with on the setting right now.
Absolutely.
And on that account, During the Infernal Reclaiming, we saw Thamorites and Morrowind followers coming together, as never before, to fight the Infernals. Mm-hmm. Can we expect that sort of alliance or unlikely alliance between different nations or groups to band together against the Orgoth?
That definitely seems possible to me, right? Like, especially with how close the royalty of Lael and Ord are right now, with their families having been intermarried, I could definitely see them having like a defensive alliance come together. Signar is probably going to benefit from some of that alliance as well. You know, it gives mm-hmm. them a buffer between Signar and the Orgoth that can allow Signar and scientists to, you know, and mechanics to observe how these new Orgoth are fighting and start to develop their own responses to it.
The Order of the Crucible Guard would certainly have something to say in this regard, because they were another one of the strong elements that helped to rebuke the first Orgoth invasion, right?
Yeah, I mean, they invented the first firearms for the Army of Thunder.
Speaking about Infernal's influence, we know that there is another separate cult or society that ruled that influenced the Orgoth. Mm-hmm. What's the scope of the Infernal's influence on the Orgoth society as a general? Do the people are aware of that? Is it having influence? Do they match the religion? What's the relationship? The relationship between Orgoth and Infernal's really like?
So the Orgoth are definitely infernal worshippers, right? But it's more transactional than it is worshipful, I guess. Mm-hmm. Like, they interact with the Felgoth Order for the purpose of gaining power, and those infernals interact with them for the purpose of gaining souls. So it's widespread throughout their culture. It's prevalent. It kind of made them, it formed them into who they are, that relationship with the Infernals.
I'm going to add a tiny one's question because this mm-hmm. piqued my interest. When the Infernals came for the claiming, did they inform Orgoth about it? Did they ask for help and they say no? How did that play out? Did they were aware at all of it?
So those two factions of Infernals are actually at odds with one another.
There you go.
Because they're all looking for the currency of souls, right? So when the Nonokrian Order tried to initiate the claiming, I think it's what incentivized the Felgoth to say to their Orgoth allies, like, hey, you remember the people that beat you so long ago? Well, there you go. The jerks down the hall are kicking them around right now, so those jerks are going to be losing some of their resources, and the people that beat you are losing a lot of their resources. It might be time to put the sails back on the boats, boys.
And what sort of interaction will we be seeing between the Felgoth Infernals and the Nonokrian Infernals? Can you tell us something about that, Matt?
I think that this is where we see the Felgoth trying to make their play. Mm-hmm. Against the Nonokrian Infernals.
Okay, so it's not only a second coming to Western Morin trying to reclaim their old empire, but also a sort of faction war between Infernal factions?
You could definitely put it that way.
Are the Infernals going to aid the Morin in the fight?
That's an interesting question. I don't know, honestly. Like, the Nonokrian Order already did aid against the Orgoth once with the Gift of Magic, right? Yeah. So
right.
I can see them being torn by, like, oh man, do we try and take some of these souls while we still can and pay off our soul debt to our bosses, or do we help these guys beat up these jerks? Like, I can see it being a very difficult decision for Agathon.
That's so really...
I can picture Agathon coming back and saying, guys, I know I tried to murder half of you, but 2/3. We have a new enemy. I want to help you. No, really, believe me.
The past is in the past. The past is in the past. No. Don't dwell on it. Just roll with it. It's fine. It's fine, guys.
Just water under the bridge. Water under the bridge.
Yeah.
So you heard it first here on Cuarto de Guerra. The new theme force for Infernos will be Hearts of Lightness, and will be all the traitors coming back to help the Organization factions. But they're all friends now. I'll play that.
I really hope Jason and Wilson don't listen to this particular episode.
Nah, they probably won't.
Sending this episode to him right after.
Oh no.
More one Samurai Infernal Mixed Theme List.
I'll play this.
That sounds balanced. Anyway,
I'll play that.
Okay. So let's move on from this before Matt just cuts the call with us. Let's keep going. What else we got, guys?
Okay. Before the Orgoth came back, we had a lot of Orgoth artifacts and ruins and stuff lying around Western Imoren. Will those be sort of reactivated? Will they have an impact on the invasion? Will all the Cador Doom Reader turn against its former masters? Will something like that happen?
I don't know if we're going to see stuff to the scope of all Doom Reavers just suddenly turning on the Grey Lords. But we do know that the Orgoth left behind, like, things that weren't destroyed in the scouring that they did before they fled the continent, their tombs and ruins and stuff like that. It's entirely possible that some of those new Orgoth landing will seek them out, seek to excavate them to reclaim, like, Grandpappy's favorite boot knife or something.
Yeah, in fact, in the Iron Kingdoms RPG, there's a type of monster that's just a big Orgoth undead that's lying around in Orgoth ruins, thinking that they're still alive. And
yeah, the Deathless. So
exactly, the Deathless. I couldn't remember the name.
Yeah, and you've got the Deathless, protected by the Entombed and the ghosts of Excruciators floating halfway through the walls. Like, there's a lot of legacy Orgoth stuff around that these new guys are going to want to reclaim and uncover.
Oh my god, I can totally see, like, one of those reality shows of treasure hunters, but Orgoth edition. I can totally see that. That's that needs to happen.
They're going to Garage Tales, and then how much for this?
I kind of want to say it's almost more like Orgoth's Storage Wars, where it's like, okay, I'm going to go for this one. Let's hope it's got something juicy inside it.
That would be awesome.
I only paid 10 gold for this cave full of Deathless.
Oh my god!
I don't know, Rick. That seems false.
Oh, and I got the locker with all the old underwear. God damn it.
Ben, you wanted to say something?
Well, just to mention that's an excellent background for any character with using the RPG, using the new rules and you know, material. I think that background is awesome for, like, an archaeologist, but now combined with these efforts of recovering things. Like, I mean, I will do that.
So, like an Orgoth nerd that wants to, want all the things.
Indiana Jones, related. Please. Indiana Jones.
An Orgoth with a whip on the
hat. We should make that happen.
We can
make that conversion. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And let me tell you, that was a great opening to go into the RPG questions.
Perfect.
If Matt is okay with that.
Lay them on me.
Okay, can we expect any sort of RPG-related content to the Orgoth, be it as an expansion, a future expansion, or a DLC like the recent Doom Reaver DLC that Privateer Press released?
So we're still working through the upcoming release for the RPG, and we've got a lot of smaller side projects like the DLCs that you mentioned. So it's not an immediate thing on my list of to-dos for the RPG, but you know, that list is only so long. So after a cycle of production, then we go, okay, let's look at what our options are. Let's see what we want to do next, what excites us, and what would provide like unusual, new, or interesting material for the role-playing game.
Okay, okay. So what you're saying is that you're open to it.
Right? Yes.
And that we should bribe you for it, right? That's yeah. What's your drink of preference? We can send you something.
Ben should. We had a conversation about this.
I already know exactly what he wants, so it will be not.
There you go. So nice. when that DLC comes out, you can thank Horto de Guerra for it. That's all
and then just for the people hearing the this episode, we had a lots of conversation with Matt about tequila. So you know now that that's his drink of preference. And so if you want to bribe him, just send a lot of tequila to his house or his work.
Specifically,
his work.
Specifically, a really good añejo. Like that is my preference. Just I know. To sit down with it and sip it. Oh, like.
Oh, right. you don't want to know what Ben does with good tequila.
I've heard.
Yeah. But he's Mexican, so he can do it. It's fine. It's totally fine. So we're little segue. Matt, if you ever decide to visit Uruguay, that's where we are right now. We kind of sort of convinced Ben to move here, so he's living with us right now. Nice. In the country, not in the house.
Not in the room,
Not in the room, right? But yeah, if you ever decide that you want to spend your holidays here, we promise tequila and barbecue. That's something that we can promise.
And healthy amounts of meat.
Unhealthy.
Those both sound amazing to me. I like both of those.
So you heard it. That's an open invitation. Right? Matt is coming to Uruguay to eat asado and drink tequila. That's it's happening. Okay. Moving on. Sorry.
Being based on 5th edition of Dungeons and Dragons, it's one of the greatest options in role playing in the current role playing world. To make very crazy combinations of races, factions, because they remove the limitations about, okay, if you want this class, you have to bring these races. And even sometimes it was limited by beliefs, by biological sex, and all of that. So they just gave freedom to do all the things that you wanted to do. Is this something that... you can see happening with Iron Kingdom? Because I know that you are basically offering the same idea, because you can have like a Gober Kicking Monk, for example, right? Mm-hmm. But is this something that you have heard has caused friction with players that are more like purists, like, no, a Gober will never be a Kriegs commander or something like that? Like, have you heard like this resistance as a feedback given to you or your team or the company since you released Iron Kingdoms?
So there have been opinions on both sides, right? Wow. There are those purists that remember the second edition of the game where there were a lot of prerequisites for specific classes. And if that's how they want to play their game, that's totally fine with me. But I also want to provide for the people who have, you know, a really good but unorthodox idea for their character and have a specific story they want to tell. And if you look back through the old lore, like, we've done that too. Even in the purest days, like Cromac the Ravenous is a great example. Cromac was one of the only Tharn to ever experience the wilding, which is what allows him to be a Circle Warlock. But then a little bit later on, we decided Iona the Unseen would be a Tharn Warlock, right? So we've shown our own willingness to kind of like stretch those expectations and limitations for characters. And I want players of Requiem to have that same liberty.
Yeah, I think that's great. Embracing the freedom that gives is it helps your player bring to life whatever the concept they fell in love with. And I was just worried that there was some pressure from purist players to not go through that direction or having that like philosophy. So I'm glad to hear that you're doing the same.
Yeah, I think that bringing the concept of essence from the second edition RPG to Requiem was pure genius. It opens up so many options for your characters. It is great. Have you received positive feedback about that, Matt?
Yeah, there have definitely been people who like the essences. When we were developing Requiem, we had heard rumors that Wizards of the Coast would be doing something different with character creation as far as races and ability mm-hmm. bonuses go. We didn't know what that was, but we knew, like, not only is that the trend that the industry was headed toward, but, like, bioessentialism and saying that all people of this race have this specific physical quality, like, it just didn't land with us. We wanted to mm-hmm. have options to build characters with, you know, a more realistic range of capabilities that weren't shackled to their race. Like, that just felt kind of icky, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
and cool. Taking the second of your two ability modifiers and attaching it to your character's background, which is the other half of that, you know, it allows your character's ability stats to be kind of shaped by their background to give an indication of, like, oh yeah, I have +1 strength, not because, you know, I'm an orc, but because I worked as a dock worker for 5 years and just built my muscles.
Yeah, which always, like, tying your rules to a meaning or a something that fits the concept of the character feels like more, you own more your history and your behavior, and not just you are a collection of stats.
I like it. My goblin is going to have +1 strength because he got into CrossFit.
Nice. did you do the thing where you wiggle the ropes?
Yeah.
Please don't encourage him. He's not really going to do that.
They're going to have to suffer it, Matt, so you're okay. Just encourage me. It's fine. You're not going to have to be on the receiving end of that on a table, so it's fine.
I don't know which concept will be worst among us, but we'll see.
I mean, you are the snowflake, Ben, so I'm expecting you to make the weirdest fucking character ever.
I heard some horror stories from Bernie, so I'm not sure. He can beat me on.
Just horny bard.
No. I just played once horny bard, but it was quite memorable. The thing is, you haven't really played RPG until you play with Alvaro, and he has made some voices. Those are really, yes, really special.
I like making voices.
As do I.
Matt.
Right? It's like half of the fun. Come on.
It is. It's.
Yeah. Matt gets it. See? Matt gets it. There, in your faces.
Oh, God. Okay, moving on, please. Yes. More about the arcane role-playing stuff.
Yes.
There was one thing that happened through recently, which was the release of role-playing only miniatures. Like there was like a set of some models that were offered that were clarified that were never meant to be used on War Machine and Hordes. Because we saw a kind of like a discussion about this, but we sometimes only see one side of the conversation as players. Which will be more interesting to know is on your side, on the production side, your feedback side, what has been the overall feeling about these, and if it was like an idea that was accepted enough for it to become something mainstay, so that we will expect something similar later. What can you tell you about that?
So we definitely enjoyed having those miniatures in the Borderlands and Beyond Kickstarter because it allowed us to take kind of interesting new looks at certain things, like the soulless assassin that's in that set. As far as like other people's responses to it, I don't think anybody's had them in hand outside of the production office yet, but there were definitely people who were saying like, I need to use that as a such and such, or I'm going to have a character that's based on like the, I think it was the heavy sharpshooter one. Right. So we saw enough positive feedback on that, that we're definitely going to be doing more role-playing miniatures in the near future. Depending on how the RPG continues to be released, like you might end up seeing a more mainstream version of that than just what was on the Kickstarter, but that's all dependent on how the RPG is reaching people's hands. So if it's going through crowdfunding, it'll be attached to whatever that current theme is for crowdfunding.
It's cool to see that on this account, Pratir Press is also going full circle on with their history, because not only PPE started as an RPG company with the Witchfire trilogy and the Iron Kingdom RPG, but they also started with the RPG only related miniatures that didn't have a War Machine and Hordes rules, and we're going back to it. Right.
Yeah. Oh God, what was his name? Warcaster Damian Sperling or something like that. He was one of those old school RPG miniatures from when the Character Guide and World Guide were released.
Yeah, I don't remember him specifically, but I do remember there was a Winter miniature. There was a Caspia Guard miniature. There was Alexia Cianor War Machine miniature.
Captain Hellstrom of the City Watch and
exactly
Pandor Duma and everything. Yeah, those were some fun ones, definitely.
Right. So it's interesting to me that. Like we know the lore and we know the RPG through the game, right? So at least I do. That's how I got to know it. It's so weird to me to think that there's people that only know the RPG and do not play the game. So I think it's wonderful that people that do not play the game also get their minis. So I mean they can go and buy like I don't know a unit of whatever and use it on the RPG, but now they have like minis especially made for them, and I think that's really cool, and that adds a lot for them, because we tend to think as gamers as war gamers, and that's fine. I mean it's you do you right, but but yeah, and sometimes we war gamers can be very. I'm sorry, I'm going to say it. We can be very bitchy. It's a thing that we do. And we are used to stuff like right now with Poverty Press, like Riot Quest models that it's for another game, but, oh, look, they also have Rule for War Machine. And, of course, the negative nuances are going to be, oh, why are you releasing this model that does not have War Machine rules and whatever, but I think it's fine. I think it's wonderful that there is a mini for every player out there, even if you are only RPG player and not a War Machine Hordes or whatever player. So I like it, I support it, and I hope to see more of that, because when I start playing the game, because we all back the Kickstarter and we have the books and we are just waiting for an excuse to sit down and play, I want to make my own character. I want to if I want go and get a mini unrelated to the game and just play it. I'm looking forward to it. So,
and also we can't forget that this, you feel free to correct me on this account, Matt, but it sort of frees a Privateer Press to make miniatures like I will say, for the sake of making a cool miniature, because like it or not, making a new War Machine and or Horde model implies a lot of design work and balancing
acts
and that takes resources, right?
Yeah, absolutely, it does.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so another question that got sort of lost about the RPG. We did have, we saw recently a sneak peek showing some information about the upcoming Nightmare Empire expansion, right? Which showed the Blood Witch and the Raider as new class options. We know that the War Witches and the Raiders are part of the Orgoth culture. So can we expect for these new classes, Orgoth-based subclasses, such as the beforehand mentioned War Witches on with their Path of Shadows that you wrote about in the lore articles?
Mm-hmm. So there are some Orgoth-informed subclasses. So you mentioned the War Witches, which were in Orgoth tradition in the first place. So we have a rogue archetype that's the War Witch Siren. And we were very specific that it would be the War Witch Siren so that we could preserve design space for mm-hmm. other types of War Witches down the road if we decided that we wanted to have them. As far as Orgoth-specific subclasses in Nightmare Empire, no, we're mostly focusing on the Shard Islands, Krix, and like the people of the Broken Coast with it, not dipping too deep into Orgoth, other than stuff that was inspired by them, like War Witches and Soul Cages and stuff like that.
Awesome. And since you mentioned the design process, how closely do you look at the existing lore or to design the rules for upcoming class or subclasses options, and or does that design the work inform future lore writing? Maybe it was a little complicated.
A little bit. Let's see if I can parse through all that. So there's definitely a relationship between the fiction and the rules. They're not perfect parity with one another. Like it's not one-to-one because you're looking to strike balance in the game while still sounding like you're being true to what these models are supposed to be doing. But if you look at, like, for instance, the old witch in fiction versus her on the tabletop, or the Harbinger in fiction versus on the tabletop, there are definitely limitations to what they can do in the war game, right? But every design decision starts with a story, right? It all has to start with a concept, a kernel of a story there. And I think part of your question was asking about like mining the lore when coming up with new concepts. That absolutely happens. If you look at the Infernal faction, Lord Roger de Viros, I think his name is, he is in the old Iron Kingdom's world guide because he used to be in Corvus, right? So there are definitely those references that you'll see plucked from older and older lore that comes to form as a miniature or as a model in the game.
Pardon? Yes, sometimes there is a relationship within the rules and the character, but sometimes you can't actually reflect the real power level, for instance, of a character. You said, I think it was you that said that the Lord of the Feast, on the rules, in the fluff, it should be an unstoppable killing machine, a god of the forest. And so it happens on the play mat. So sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's give some context to Matt here. I play Circle, and I have touched Bernardo's armies in places with Lord of the Feast a number of times. So it's a returning gag on the podcast.
That I believe during the introductions he said, "And I hate Lord of the Feast." So
yes,
yeah,
I do.
Now in English, that is true. He
that's
really
how I introduce myself every day to when I'm working.
Nice.
Yeah, like work meetings. Hi, my name is Bernardo. I hate Lord of the Feast. No, that's weird. What are you talking about? But yeah, it's that bad. Anyway.
We just have a couple of questions left. One, okay. I don't know if Ben, was it you that wrote the number 12? Did any related question?
Oh yeah, it was more like wondering about kind of the storytelling or the different models where you bring back known characters like the story that we play together, the introduction model, where we know a little bit about the history of Haley and Danny, and at the end we heard about that final letter from Danny, which was very epic, very well written, very suspenseful. Mm-hmm. Wondering what brings you more interested in bringing back these characters with more narratives, more models tied to their story or their continuation of the story? Or do you prefer to bring new characters into life? Like now that there are many things have happened, and we're kind of injecting new blood into the lore. What is the kind of like your intention and of course your influence in future stories?
So when it comes to either the older established characters like Denegra or Haley, I absolutely love going back to them and referencing them or giving some updates to the fiction of what they've been doing and where they're going, right? Like, that's one of the great strengths of Requiem, is it allowed us to look at all those old characters and kind of find out what they've made of themselves after the claiming. But just as much, new characters are awesome because you have new perspectives, you have new opportunities, both as a writer and a player, right? You get to make up new narratives and learn how they respond to things. So I'm in both camps, frankly, the wanting to keep touch with the roots of the setting and the characters that everybody knows and is well established in, and also introducing them to these new characters.
Great. I think that's the best of both worlds. Like, your answer gave us everything that we wanted individually. Like, we want to expand the lore, but also some focus on new blood, new characters, new stories will be exciting to read about. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I have one question that wasn't in the original list, but don't worry. It isn't risky or anything.
Oh, okay.
I think I can speak for all of us when I say that the Henchhold scrolls were truly a hit. When can we see those reactivated? Because it was a time that we were all, as a community, at least locally, expecting to see the next installment of the scrolls day after day. Okay, they were another scroll got released. It's a 10-part tweet.
Yeah. So there was a bot created on the Discord server that posted the scrolls for the people that didn't have Twitter. So that's how into it we were. Yeah.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. So your question is, are we going to go back to the Henchhold scrolls story? So mm-hmm. we recently did the second part where it kind of let everyone know what the consequences of all the setting up in the first part was.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the story of the Henchhold scrolls is done, because the battle at Henchhold is over, right? If we were to re-up the project, it would be a different story, a different perspective. It wouldn't be the Henchhold scrolls. It'd be like the Orgoth cometh or something, right?
Yeah, I think the question
Let me rephrase the question.
Yeah.
Will you be bringing back the Twitter format?
The format.
Sure.
That's a great question. Yeah.
Microfiction.
Like, the microfiction is definitely interesting. It's not something that I personally have a lot of time to do right now, like I did for the first Tendril Scroll. But if we have a big story that we can tell, I don't see why we would get rid of that as a platform.
Yeah, no, it was magical to see mm-hmm. so many people expecting the next scroll, and whatever action the company can do to bring together the community globally, I think it's the best thing you could do.
I absolutely agree.
And this gave a lot of things to talk about. There was a lot of feedback. I don't think anyone or no one said, "Oh, I don't like it," or "I thought that was boring," and they should.
It was an unquestionable hit.
You're right.
In the Facebook groups, in the WhatsApp groups, in Discord groups,
everywhere. And I like the fact that you never knew what was coming, and you were always expecting something related to your faction. Like,
sure.
We're going to talk about Circle. Oh, is it today? Oh, yes, it is. Yeah, yeah.
Nice.
That's something that it's really cool, and we really enjoy it. And I think that ties. It's a nice segue for the last question, right, guys?
First of all, if the problem for the Henschel scores or microfiction in general, the problem is the lack of writers. I fully volunteer to write about the Orgoth invasion to the Circle lands. I'll do it for free. I'll pay for that.
I'll pass that along.
Great! I'll do it for free. I'll pay for that.
The Lord of the Feast slow death, a 30 part tweet scroll,
something like that, right? Oh my god, that would be so fun. I think you should write it anyway, Bernardo. Just do it.
Oh, I will, but I will.
Matt, whose idea was it to bring the microfiction to Twitter platform?
I believe that was Aaron Rudell. He was the editor-in-chief of No Quarter magazine, and he wrote the Acts of War series, as well as many, many other things. But he is the one that first approached Matt Wilson about doing the microfiction on Twitter.
Well, you can tell him from all of us that we think that was a stroke of genius.
Okay, I'll pass it along.
Yep, indeed.
Okay. And going to the last question, as we saw, all of this brings the opportunity for lots of new narratives. So the question is, will the second Orgoth invasion be an opportunity to bring back the Privateer Press fiction line in some form, be it physical books, ebooks, or the Fire and the Forge series that started to recount all the recent history in No Quarter Prime?
So I can't say. I don't really know if there are plans in the works to bring back physical or ebook fiction in that form. But what I can say is, with the role-playing games, like, we're using a lot of the narrative in it to provide that fictional in and give you a sense of what that advancement is, especially in the adventures. The adventures are a way to push the story of the setting, like with Shadow of the Seeker and building up to getting into Eidos and seeing how Eidos has really been fundamentally changed, but not doing so as an observer, doing so as a participant is a kind of fun way to consume the story.
That's fair, and I think that we are going to consume that content eagerly.
Nice.
Let's hope that we get more fiction independently, but we will take what we can get. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Okay, so I also have a bonus question before we finish, because we are almost... Oh, Ben is... Sorry.
No, it was just agreeing with you, Alvaro, where I think it's great a great idea to give more content for the role-playing, and also ties together the story, the advancement of everything that's happening through those stories, to those models. It is more incentive for us to combine both games and to experience both games at the same time, or just people that just want to know the story still become consumers of the content and pay for it. So I think that that's a great initiative. Not necessarily we will be needing just like books or stories being published or released. I think these kills two beers with one stone.
Okay, so we have had Matt here for like almost an hour. We should let him go. But first, yeah, I know. Oh, no, Cindy, don't worry.
I want to ask Matt another unscripted question that can be totally get in line. Out of the episode.
Get in line. I'm first. Okay. So this one is sort of like an open question for him, and he can tell us what he wants. But here is the ambush. No, it's not. No, I promise it's not. So, what can you tell us if you want to tell us, what character Orgot related character should we be ready or on the lookout for, lore related, on this invasion? Like who one of the main players, let's say like that. Is there something that you can tell us without any giving away any spoilers about that?
Who's
the Orgoth Agathon?
Not yet. I can't spoil anything like that yet. We do know that the War Witch Supreme, the Mother Tenebris War Witch, is one of the driving forces behind this invasion. But I kind of want to look back, because you know how I was talking about I like new characters, but I also like touchstone references to old ones.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
One of the things to keep your eye on is Egregor from the Witch Coven. Ooh. Because Egregor is not Crixion. Egregor is Orgoth.
Yeah.
I love it.
There you go. See, guys? Unscripted questions. Always for the win. There we go. That's awesome, man. That's all I ever wanted. That's amazing. And I'm happy. Okay. I'm happy that I asked. Okay, Santiago, you do your question, and then we can just let Matt go.
What can you tell us about future releases? Emphasis on can tell us.
Yeah.
We know that the next RPG expansion is the Nightmare Empire. Can you tell us what is in the works after that?
I can tell you about some of the stuff that's going to be like between now and Nightmare Empire and immediately after Nightmare Empire.
I like it.
DLCs that we've been putting out. We're kind of doing them in War Machine Hordes faction or Iron Kingdoms nation sort of blocks conceptually. So we did the Doom Reaver, and the next one you're going to see is the Man of War for a short Kador block. But then we're going to jump completely over to Circle Ouroboros and give you like the Black Clad as a class.
I know what I'm playing.
The Tharn as a playable race and a subclass for them. And then after that, we're probably going to dip our toes in like Signar or something, and then just kind of move faction to faction, you know, one or two releases for each one to fill in the gaps, so to speak.
Okay. And I know this may not even be on the table, but once though a certain amount of DLC have been released and tested and taken into account the reception, could there be a sort of compilation in print about of those?
It's certainly a possibility. We've done stuff like that before with the Immortality Adventure or the Forces of Distinction theme forces. So, yeah, having that material and putting it into a compilation is absolutely a possibility. It's just a question of, you know, when that would fall in line priority wise and stuff.
Yeah,
the electronic DLCs are great for usability, but I really like printed books.
Oh, so do I.
I rather laugh because he knows me.
Santiago is a RPG book obsessive. compulsive buyer, and he has like I think that behind that drawer behind you, it's full of books.
Yeah, no, I mean, no, it's the library next to me. You can.
Oh, there you go. There you go. So, yeah.
What role playing game player doesn't have their pile of shame? Like I have my own, right? So.
Yeah. Oh no, but Santiago is not ashamed. It's his prize, possession, yeah. And his pride of it. Proud of it, yeah, for sure. I mean, some of them have never been opened, but they're his.
See, that's why it's the pile of shame when you have all these books that you've purchased, but you've never gotten to play.
Oh, yeah.
I don't care. My children will inherit them. I don't know if they will want to inherit them, but they will.
Before we say our goodbyes, I have a request for Matt. So we had an old fight with Santiago, and at some point during your writing your adventure, your models where Orgoth are related, please write something where some Orgoth caster comes into land riding in the sea in a seahorse. Like describe him getting into the land on a seahorse.
We had a
very long fight about what we expected from Orgoth, where we didn't know anything about how the models would look like. And I was theorizing that because they were like riders of the sea, Viking, some kind of lore with sea monsters, like Viking lore, sea monsters, and I thought, okay, seahorses will be great concept. But Santiago was, no, I hate that. No, this has to be the other way. So.
If you think about an invading army striking fear in the hearts of the Western immorants,
you can get.
I can't relate that to a seahorse.
It's a frowning seahorse. It's frowning at you. It's terrifying.
It's very angry.
Ben wanted
very angry seahorse.
Ben wanted Santiago, to have... I feel like this is a fight that I shouldn't step in the middle of.
you probably shouldn't.
You are very, very wise. Well, yeah. Okay. I think that on that high note. Yeah, there could be. I agree. But on that very high note, I think it's time to wrap this up. Matt, we are extremely thankful for your willingness to put yourself through this for us. So, yeah.
You're very welcome, and it's definitely been a joy for me.
All right. I'm glad that it was at least bearable, and we hope to have you again on a future occasion to discuss something wonderful and new. We are all Privateer Press fanboys. We are all Iron Kingdom fanboys, and we are really, really excited to see all this new content coming out. So thank you so very much for joining us. And we hope that everything works wonderful with the new releases.
Thank you so much.
No, it's our pleasure. Okay, so with that said, this has been episode number 7 of the season 3 of Cuarto de Guerra. My name is Álvaro.
My name is Bernardo.
Bernardo, there you go.
My name is Santiago.
My name is Ben.
And
there we go. And this was
Cuarto de Guerra.
Seahorses.
I really like that Alvaro is Cuarto de Guerra.
Of course, you have to do that. It's part of it.